Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We can't be in the same room, but a podcast can't be stopped. The cinemas are empty, the industry is fucked, but we won't log off. We're not going out, we're staying at home. And when we watch films, we watch them alone. We sit in our pants, stick on something crap, and then we hit Skype for a little chat.
Film Chat's been on a little break. What have we been doing? I haven't been doing very much.
You'll find out. We can't talk about it. We're doing a top secret thing that took a lot of time.
Top secret project. Making the coronavirus vaccine. But it's done now.
We were getting Brexit done, I'm pretty sure.
We're sorting Brexit out. So we've had a lot to do. But now we're back to our main priority, which is making this great podcast. So, Danny, How's it handling?
Same old. I mean, I think maybe the reason we've been having a bit of a hiatus is that I don't know about you, but I've got very little to say or contribute to anything. I kind of wonder whether I've like lost the art of conversation. I'm not sure if I had it before, the lockdown. But like, every once in a while when I meet somebody, it's like, I still find myself saying stuff. It's like, my God, I'm boring. Like, you know. Without the culture around, it stagnated, and I realized that was necessary for me to appear like a normal person with views and opinions. But now I'm just, it's been stripped away, and I realize I'm actually quite dull.
You know, when you meet somebody who you were friends with at school and you hadn't seen in the intervening years, and then you were looking forward to seeing them again, and then you realize that without being able to talk about teachers and today's timetable, you know, or the GCSEs or whatever, then you don't actually have any topics of conversation. Maybe that's what's happened to us, you know, like, without a regular schedule of film releases, we just are unable to contribute on any subject. I think I'm currently running on about 20% of regular life force, you know, a shadow of my normal self. But we just had an injection of meat into that podcast sandwich in the form of the one film, a film being projected on a screen so large that it's single-handedly resuscitating the film industry, Christopher Nolan's Tenet. If anyone's the man to defeat a global pandemic with a great big explosion, it's him.
To do what I do, I need some idea of the threat we face.
As I understand it, we're trying to prevent World War III.
I'm not saying Armageddon here.
No. Something worse.
I gather you have an interest in a certain Russian national.
Mike, bring me in.
You really want to know?
He can communicate with the future.
Time travel.
No.
Inversion.
He's filmed some of the biggest explosions he could film. He's strung them together with some of the most expensive suits money can buy, and put a crazy time travel twist on it, and we all just get to expose ourselves to a deadly virus and enjoy it.
Yeah, and boats. He's into boats now, it feels like. I feel like post-Dunkirk, he really got into boats, and so that was just like, just so many boats in this new one. It's like, I think it's a real midlife crisis thing. But like, most people buy Ferraris, but he's like, nah, bring me the biggest boats you got. Bigger. Yeah, good.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Tenet. that's the main topic of discussion, the main course, and we'll see where else the this free-flowing ramble takes us. But first of all, I want to ask you about your cinema experience. So I assume neither of us had set foot in a cinema. Well, I know I hadn't, but I assume you hadn't either, since all this kicked off. And what was it like? Where did you go see it? How did you find the whole thing?
Well, I just went to my local multiplex, which is maybe a poor show on my part. I should be out there supporting the independent cinemas.
But it's unethical of you.
It was unethical of me, but the independent cinema was like a bit too far away. It wasn't showing at a convenient time. So, you know, I just squared that with my conscience quite quickly. It was fine, really. I think out of all the sort of lockdown activities, it's probably the most, one of the safer ones. Like, me and my girlfriend went and I was like a matinee screening. There's hardly anyone there. You pay online, you know, it feels like there's not that many people there. Because, like, I went, I don't know if you took advantage of the Eat Out to Help Out, but I feel that was more, like, risky. I was, like, brushing shoulders with more people doing that than going to the movies. So I kind of feel like more people should go to the cinema. But then maybe if everyone did that, then it wouldn't be safe. So it was fine for me, really.
I don't actually know exactly how to gauge levels of risk exactly, like... When I saw it in the Genesis cinema.
An independent cinema.
So I did support an independent cinema.
Well, at least one of us
ethically,
did.
And saw it in their little studio screen with only sofas inside. And my girlfriend and I were just enjoying a little sofa together. Ooh. Not really near any other humans. How sexy did that sound?
Enjoying a little sofa together.
It's very erotic, yeah. But we weren't, I was not rubbing up against other people eating popcorn or anything like that. So it felt relatively distanced in that way. But at the same time, we're indoors. So I guess that is, and you're indoors sitting in the same place for a long time. I don't know how it works. Like if someone breathes out a cloud of viral germs, do they, that's not a thing, I know. But whatever, the virus comes out of someone's orifices. Does the cloud dispersed into the room and fill it like a noxious gas, or is it fine as long as you're, you know, like if you're 3 meters away from somebody but they're sitting there for two full hours, you know, is that dangerous? I don't know. But I also ate out and helped out, but then we were eating outside, so it was an al fresco meal. So is that safe? I don't know, Danny. I mean, who's to blame? The government's poor messaging or me for not Googling these things before I do them? What's the...
Fucking Boris.
Who's taking the risks here?
Fuck the government. Fuck Boris.
The important thing is that we got to see Christopher Nolan's film. But I agree that I didn't feel like I was at risk. I mean, I don't know whether my feelings have any relevance to it, but
it
certainly didn't feel too bad.
That Christopher Nolan, this is a criticism often leveled at him, but he makes very sterile films. His films seem very clean, you know? Like,
yes.
There's nothing sensual... or like emotive about them. So it's quite clinical to be. Maybe if I was watching like a movie, which like a Pedro Almodovar movie, I'd be a bit more on edge because I'd be more aware of my body and human emotions and stuff.
They have that white halogen color palette of a laboratory.
Yeah, exactly.
Feels like everything's been sprayed down. Okay, so we both lived to tell the tale so far. What did you think of the film itself?
Should we try and do the plot? I don't know, like a brief little setup. So John David Washington plays a spy simply called the protagonist. And early on in the movie, he is kind of recruited. His mission is to find out about these objects, these kind of weapons that are going back in time. He's got bullets that fly into guns. The entropy has been reversed. And there's some sort of global conspiracy. And he has to sort of, it's like a sort of Bond movie. He has to follow the clues. There's a bad guy. And he has to stop World War III, but it's like even worse than World War III because it's like World War III from the future. As I say this, I realize none of this is really making sense. I don't quite understand the film, so I don't think I can spoil it. Is that sort of reasonable enough?
Yeah, it's a big spy movie. There's a big doomsday device, and he's kind of traveling back in time and forwards in time, and time stuff is going on as he tries to tackle the issue. And the big bad guy is Kenneth Branagh as a Russian arms dealer doing a chef's kiss of a Branagh performance. So this has been received with slightly more middling reviews, right, than your regular Nolan Bechdel.
Yeah, people seem a bit cooler on this one.
I was kind of anticipating they were going to give it a little more leeway because people are so cinema starved and they'd be like, you know, this is big Bechdel, this is the big Nolan, like this must be amazing. But maybe just the weight of expectations was too much for people on this one. Yeah, I will say that I quite liked it. I think that it has all of Nolan's weaknesses, and definitely some of them are worse than they are in his other films. And it's there are certain ways in which it's definitely not like the best film in his oeuvre. But I always situate his movies as compared to watching another brainless blockbuster, because that is essentially what, like, that's the slot that these movies are in. This is the same kind of thing as going to see like a Marvel film or like Fast and Furious or whatever. It's big, expensive popcorn entertainment, and what I'm looking for is just for the time to pass in an enjoyable way over that period, and for me to see a lot of money spent in an interesting way on screen. And I feel like the film did deliver on that level. So I was relatively satisfied by Tenet. And even, it is definitely a film where, even in the ways in which it is stupid, they're fun to think about and talk about. And it gives you some stuff to chew over. And I feel like it doesn't have the same quality of disappearing from your mind seconds after you have seen it, which I'd experienced watching a few of these recent like Netflix blockbuster releases, which are just aim squarely to get 3 stars and for you to like never be so bored you'll turn it off, you know. And that's like the limits of their ambition. And then you sort of, you watch the whole thing without ever feeling uncomfortable or sad or upset or moved anyway, and then it's over and you're like, well, I'll just do the next thing in my life and never think about this film again. And as compared to that sort of replaceable fare, Nolan remains a someone who makes more sort of interesting and enjoyable and memorable movies than that. So I appreciated its existence, even if I don't know if it's like a good film. What was your view?
No, I broadly agree. I think I just like, it's almost like he's a brand unto himself, and I just like the things he does. And there's just some, you know, there's some spectacles like that, you know. There's some spectacles.
A lot of guys in glasses.
Yeah. I realized that was confusing. You know, people in expensive suits, and there's a big set piece. There's an explosion. They, you know, they bought out a house and blew it up for real. And all the in-camera stuff is almost like, it's so expected now. I wonder if he's almost like, he keeps trying to top himself. And I don't think he has. I think if there was like a flaw, there are many flaws, it's like it doesn't quite have a sort of standout amazing sequence or like anything as good as like the zero gravity fight in Inception or the docking sequence in Interstellar. I always think there's like, even in his like flawed movies, a real like standout sequence. I don't think this one quite has one on that level. The government said, like, I thought gave a really good hot take review, which is like, it's really entertaining moment to moment, but at the end you're like, what was that? And I think like the whole movie is a bit like a puzzle which isn't quite intriguing enough for me to want to try and figure it out. And I did watch a video which was like, you know, Tenet explained, and I was like, nah, like, because I don't think there's much going on like more than the concepts. It's just more like, it's a very kind of shallow movie with just kind of character types. They're not really characters. I mean, the fact that he's called the protagonist is almost like sort of a kind of winking reference to how flimsy the script is. Like Robert Pattinson should just be called best friends. Kenneth Branagh is just villain, and Elizabeth Debicki, in probably the worst role, is just like wife. And there's very, and they all do a lot, I think, to sort of like sketch around that a bit more. But the whole thing just felt like a very expensive, really hard to make film, which was ultimately very lightweight. And the sort of complexity gives it the illusion of that there's more going on, when really it just felt a bit like his latest thing. He's like, I've done zero gravity stuff, I've done dream stuff. The new thing is time in reverse. I don't know what he's going to do after this. Like, time in reverse and zero gravity at the same time. He's got to find a new thing to reverse. But I did really like the main guy. I thought John David Washington was great. Really convinced as like a sort of action star. Like, one of the standout sequences is just him sort of kicking ass in a very like generic spy way, or like, you know, 5 goons surround him and they're all like built like brick shit houses, and he's like somewhat smaller compared to them, but he's just so fucking badass, he takes them down. And I really bought it more than like any other movie I've seen recently. I was like, shit, this guy could tear me apart. So I thought he was great.
This guy could smash me to pieces.
This guy could smash me to pieces.
This guy could hold me down and just wreck me.
But yeah, we discussed this a little bit. I had no idea what's happening in the third act. Like, I felt that was the kind of wheels came off the movie slightly, in that his weird time thing the actual, the very concept of the plot, I didn't quite understand, and then how it operated. You know, the premise is confusing, and then the way the story is constructed is like in a typical Nolan nonlinear fashion. So by the end, I had no fucking clue what was going on. It was very confusingly shot, I think. Like, the actual geography of what was going on wasn't very clearly done. And I think it was, like, really expensive, but it lacked a bit of the sort of epicness of his other movies. It was... I think it wasn't as, like, good-looking a movie as, like, his previous ones.
Yeah, it has this interesting aesthetic, which I think is quite Nolan-y, but is sort of more the case in this than in any of his other movies. Like, he just likes daylight and things to be clear and crisp, and he's not an overly, like, he isn't somebody, in a way that is sort of refreshing, like, he's not somebody who's gonna slather his film in neon so that you think that it's like a really cool 80s throwback, or put some filter on the camera so everything is vaguely green or blue to give you the sense that you're watching something that's very stylish. It's just everything was shot at about 2 p.m. you know, and just looks light, and I don't know. And the big car chase takes place in a sort of like a highway in Estonia that looks very ordinary, and the climax of the movie basically looks like it was filmed in an enormous paintball arena, and is also, you know, relatively mundane looking. Yeah, it isn't as visually beautiful, I guess, as like the Batman movies, or like doesn't have the period trappings of Dunkirk, or I guess the sort of cool urban sprawls which are constantly shifting around that Inception had, which definitely made it look cool. Though the finale of Inception is also in a relatively bland, like, just snow area. But that fight scene you mentioned in the kitchen, that sort of, I really liked that bit as well. And that kind of, that sort of thing buys me a lot of goodwill with Nolan, because it feels like when he just has to do some functional little bit of action, he just excels so well.
Yeah, it's
such,
yeah,
a well-directed and made little sequence. It wasn't shouting about itself as being ultra cool, but it, you know, it just was very slick and satisfyingly crunchy bit of fighting with the main dude. And yeah, I think he has this like self-assuredness with the way that his films kind of carry themselves that that I just enjoy, and I'm kind of willing to go with even when they're extremely silly. I think that the finale of this movie definitely pushes it on the visual coherence or incoherence level. Like, I did not know what was going on. I think I challenge anybody to be able to explain exactly who is doing what and why in the final half an hour of this movie. It is impossible to tell. And one of his big problems, I think, Nolan, and this is something where, this is one of his few movies that he wrote solo, and I think this is one of the things where a collaborator would have helped enormously, just to make sure the audience can understand the basics of the plot, not just the crazy mechanics of the time travel gimmick, but just who is doing what and why in each scene. It felt like every single sequence in the movie required a ultra quick fire kind of His Girl Friday style back and forth between people just shouting important plot information at each other at like a very quick rate, just to explain every new scene. Like, you needed to have this little prologue, you know. It would be like having the opening scroll in a Star Wars movie, but like they would need to do that before every single scene. Like, everything had so much setup. Like the bit in the trailer where they explode the plane, the scheme that is part of is highly elaborate. There's this whole backstory involving expensive arts that you have to learn, a whole bunch of new characters. There's all of this stuff about the security system in the thing, and like, it's like the climax to a heist movie or whatever that would tell you over and over and over again why, what's here and what's there and why they need to do what. But in this movie, it's like a couple of scenes of people saying it really, really quickly, and then you're into it and you're just like, okay, I don't have, where's the handout, you know? I need the accompanying slides, like, to be able to remember who's doing what, why. And like, all of the action scenes were a bit like that. There was too much, just too much plot, which doesn't matter. It's too much stuff that had to be explained. And it kind of reached its zenith before the final climax, where it just suddenly cut to a dude standing in front of a board pointing at a diagram as he explains like where the different teams are going in this building. And I'm like, what is the building? Who are the teams? Why are they doing this? I don't know what's happening. And then on top, so it's like on top of all of that, you get the genuinely very complicated time travel gimmicks, where even if it was all in linear time, I would be a little confused, and with all the time travel stuff on top of it, it just makes it completely visually incoherent and impossible to understand. But having said all that, the extra level of like the time nonsense does at least give you something to be working on while you're like, I don't really know who's doing what or why, but at least I can be trying to, my brain is kind of trying to puzzle through exactly how the mechanics of this are working. And I think that I feel like he is confident that this all kind of knits together and works. And that if you stare at it long enough, the magic eye will come into focus and you'll be like, oh, I see, you did this thing because of this. So it's at least, I think that does give it a level of it being interesting to watch, even though it does fail at one sort of quite fundamental thing of like making your scenes visually coherent. Like the scene which is also in the trailer where there's this sort of fist fight between the main guy and this masked dude who's moving backwards in time.
yeah.
Like he's moving forwards and he's fighting a guy who's moving backwards. I found that very cool, and that's such a challenge to choreograph. I don't know how you would choreograph that scene.
Yeah.
And it's cool that the in-camera mechanics of it are very straightforward. So you just run the film backwards, right?
Yeah.
But coming up with a way to shoot a fight scene where when you focus on what one guy's doing, that footage is in reverse, and then when the other guy, his footage seems to be going forwards, must have been an incredible endeavor to choreograph all that and shoot it and make that work. And I thought it was very cool. Like, I haven't seen that before, so...
I was
satisfied. So I was like, I gave that a thumbs up. I thought it was good. One area in which this is really falls flat compared to his previous oeuvre is the failure to give a compelling villain, and his sort of like stiffness and blandness and his terrible dialogue is definitely made up for by really well acted and interesting villains in the Batman movies. And here we've got an incredibly boring, like a Bond villain with no physical deformity or like, with no character to him, the blandest possible Russian oligarch character, played by probably the worst
working actor.
Probably the worst famous actor, Kenneth Branagh, who's just, I just feel like he is someone who I could do better than, or normal people. Like,
it's rare you watch a really expensive film and think, I could do better than this guy, and I'm not even an actor.
Yeah, which is not good at it.
Yeah, it's a shame, because it's a weird, like, on one hand, it's so supremely well made. On the other hand, the script is like, needs a couple more passes, and it's like, that's quite amateurish, and some of the dialogue is really like 6th form. It's like a sort of kid who's watched too many Bond movies and is trying his hand at writing tough guy dialogue. And then it's got all these, you know, mad time stuff, which probably took ages to do, and then like the Elizabeth Debicki character and the Kenneth Branagh character are such crap, bad genre cliches. So on one hand, it's like the most generic thing in the world. I've never had is this crazy new thing with like all this time travel stuff. So it's a kind of a mess, but it's got more going for it than most. And like, I definitely enjoyed it. I think it was just less successful than his other movies that have done similar stuff. It also didn't have a good score, I don't think. I was kind of hoping it's not Hans Zimmer this time, it's Ludwig Göransson. He's got someone else who's, you know, European and sounds like someone who could, you know, really work a synth machine. But I felt like it was lacking memorable musical cues.
It certainly has the bwoms.
It has the bwoms, but it doesn't have the cool jangly guitars and the percussion, and or maybe it did, but it just wasn't quite landing in the same way.
I thought it was kind of fine. I didn't particularly notice it, except when it was literally drowning out the dialogue, which it did a few times. I don't know if that was just an issue in the screen that I was in, but it was hard for me to follow the plot, and then I just couldn't understand what people were saying.
The sound mix is terrible, or just deliberately, like, muddy. I felt like he got into the edit and was like, this dialogue is not good. I need to drown this out. And also, there seems to be, like, almost like a... Is it like an in-joke? There's a bit where they have, like, a meeting while they're on, like, this massive, like, boat, like... going along, and they have to talk via like headpieces because the waves are so loud. And then like in a sort of completely random Michael Caine cameo, he's like eating chips just to sort of mean that his diction isn't that clear, and he's got his old man voice, and now you're making him like chew like steak at the same time. I mean, it's just not just make your audio a bit sharper. I feel like in the 70s everyone could hear each other, and now it's got this weird like it's like a Robert Altman movie, but
that's one of those things that you just have to give up on. I'm not going to be able to understand what people are saying or why they're saying it. I'm just going to have to watch 5 different Tenet Explained YouTube videos after this in order to try to work it out. But yeah, I think of all of his films, this is the one that felt the most to me as if it was set in Christopher Nolan's own kind of social world. Felt like everybody was always like, they're like on yachts, they're on planes, they're in art galleries, they're having nice lunches in restaurants. You know, they're just driving about town. Like, this is just his life, isn't it? He's just filmed his own life and he's pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into putting explosions into it. But it really felt like he is just, this is his own lifestyle, you know? You see one shot of Christopher Nolan on set in a three-piece suit, and I just feel like his entire thing falls into place.
Yeah.
Like, and this is why I have some affection for him, is because I think he's kind of unpretentious and his films are no more or less clever or deep or intelligent than they appear, you know?
Yeah.
The reason that everyone is always chewing out this absurdly corny dialogue is not because he's some kind of ultra pretentious art house genius who knows that the only way to fit his incredibly deep concepts is to feed the masses a bit of popular entertainment. It's like, no, that's just him. That's just who he is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
He just writes this nonsense. And calling your main character the protagonist is such a kind of sixth form move.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that just tells you that just tells you everything. He's called the protagonist and he has dialogue like, I am the protagonist.
Someone on Twitter described his movies as Tory anime. And I think that, like, really, that's, like, perfect.
That's so perfect.
That's perfect. Absolutely it. It's like, if you watch an anime movie, it's just guys in suits and they defy gravity occasionally. And it's all that, but with this kind of, like, weird British colonial trappings on top of that. And I did find some of the, like, bad dialogue really funny. Like, this whole thing about this, like, little public schoolboy character. I always love it when kids talk in movies and they have, like, two lines. It's like, the writer has to think of something a child would say, and this thing is like, Mommy, I want to go to Pompeii and look at the lava or something. And it's like, who is this little fucking Tory shit? It's gotta be running the country in 20 years. They should have killed that kid. That's my radical... Yeah. I've been radicalized in lockdown. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's fun. You know, I feel like I watched it, I enjoyed it, and, you know, if I never saw it again, that'd be fine, but, you know, past the time. And it is much better than, to return to your original point, like, you watch, like, I'm sure, like, if you watched Avengers Endgame, it just looked like shit now, like, 2 years later. Like, all the blue screen and green screen. I just think on the technical level, they just look amazing. All the explosions are loud. The cars drove really fast. They actually bought a jumbo jet and crashed it. I mean, sure. I mean, that's the price of a mission, isn't it? Covered, basically. So yeah, good-ish.
I was kind of on board. The first scene is just this really cool and well executed action set piece in a concert in an opera house. Another scene that's been set in Christopher Nolan's life. You know, he was going to the opera as he does like every other day, and he was like, what if armed guards, you know, burst in here and started shooting up the place? And so he just made that into a scene, but it's just really well done, you know. So fair play to him.
Don't
try to understand it. Feel it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What else have you seen?
I have seen the Jon Stewart satire, Irresistible. When you see Trump lose office by getting no votes, you're probably going to wonder how that happened. Tell you how it happened. Everyone to see this movie and they were like, wow.
The Democrat Party can't win. They're getting desperate. They don't know us. They don't want to know us. And they look down on our bodies.
No, that's we. You're DC elite.
Oh, no, actually, I'm from here.
Faith, I didn't know that. You're from Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, Deer Lake, and I'm from Deer Lake.
What? Oh. Whoa.
Wow, so this campaign has been a bit of a homecoming.
It really is, Brooke. Thank
you. No. That's a lie.
No, it's...
You're lying.
It's
she's
lying.
That's no.
Here.
That. What are you even
okay.
doing?
Well, that's always a great and spirited discussion.
No, she's lying.
She's lying.
So I think we talked about it when it was announced. The basic plot is Steve Carell's like a sort of campaign manager, Washington pro. And the beginning of the movie, it starts with like a Trump speech, which is already bad. I'm like, I thought I was settling in for like a sort of fun. rom-com comedy thing, and like, I don't want to hear Trump's voice already. That's turned me off. It's like someone's throwing a, you know, a bucket of cold water over me, and it's like it's set like on the day after like the 2016 election results, and he's really depressed. And then the movie they is about the Democrats trying to relaunch their campaign, and the way they're doing that is they saw this viral video of this farmer who used to be a military vet, played by Chris Cooper, sort of standing up in a sort of town meeting in his little town of like Americana in the Midwest, not really specified where. And Steve Carell's like, oh, if we can get this guy to win, we can win back the sort of the middle America that went to Trump, right? We're going to get the little guys in the little towns with their little minds. They didn't vote the right way because they're so little. You know, he's a patronizing guy. And so he goes there, and then, but then the sort of Republicans get wind of it, and then like Rose Byrne, who's like his sort of Republican counterpart, comes in, and there's sort of, it's kind of like a Frank Capra-esque sort of comedy about politics invading a small town. I'd say it's pretty terrible. I hate it, maybe, on reflection. It's got, the thing that's so funny about it is that it's sort of about the way, you know, big corporate campaigns use this kind of folksy America that doesn't really exist. And like, you know, Joe Biden's got to go have a barbecue with a normal guy somewhere and talk about real issues, about real Americas or whatever. And it's all very patronizing, the sort of campaigns that come out. But then Jon Stewart's depiction of the town is exactly the same as Steve Carell's perception of it. So it's like, what is it satirizing? It felt like the Steve Carell character directed the movie. It also just feels very dated, like, the sort of big target is just, like, money. The money that gets sunk into these campaigns. When it feels like the sort of issues of the day are a bit deeper than that. I mean, obviously, like, it's the social economic situation. But I don't know, I feel like this script was written about 10 years ago, is the feeling when you watch it. It's also, the tone of it is very strange. It's got this kind of high concept third act reveal, which sort of feels like a completely different film. There's a sequence where like a billionaire donor turns up and he's like, he's so old and decrepit, he's basically a robot. And it's like, what is this film? It just, I know, you're frowning at me as I say this, so like, that sounds weird, but it's not as weird as the film itself. And Steve Carell and Rose Byrne are like good. They're like such like charming performers that are sort of, you know, they kind of make the movie very watchable. But at the end, it's a movie which ends with like stats coming up. And you're like, was I supposed to learn something from this? You know, like, your movie is not smart enough. It's like, you know, if you're going to try and teach me something, you have to prove that you're smart enough to teach me something. And it was like, this is a dumb movie. It's like, Jon Stewart got out when the going was good. You know, he left in, like, early 2016, which was the perfect time to leave that kind of format of satire. And it feels like he's returning to the crime scene. I'm like, was he even that good? You know, like, so I give it a miss. I mean, it's sort of come out and died and no one went to see it. I think that's probably a good thing.
What you said about it does chime with other things that I've heard people talk about it. I think Jon Stewart is an interesting figure because it felt like he was, you know, very sharp and on it in his day, although I suppose that we still have to wonder whether that was just how we felt at the time, you know, when we were 14 or 15, and whether that stuff would still hold up in retrospect. But he does have something that distinguishes him from the regular stable of smirking satirists, both in the UK and in the US, which is that he's genuinely a very angry man. You know, he's got some hate in his heart, so you've got to give him some credit for that. He's also a political campaigner, and he's a liberal, so it's not like his politics are amazing, but he is at least mad about something and wants to kind of fix it. And it just sounds like this movie is such a combination of those two parts of him, you know, this kind of pleased with itself, chirpy political satire from this like kind of format which is dated, and that's in a form which is kind of toothless, you know, like all those years kind of railing against Democrats and Republicans while also inviting them onto your show and shaking their hand and being charming with them and doing absolutely nothing to actually challenge them. And the film is kind of suffering from the same problem, you know, this like toothless kind of satire, which is attempting to reveal something about the, you know, the poisonous nature of money in politics, but its reach is always exceeding its grasp. Like, satire is interesting in how quickly it dates in a way, and Jon Stewart is certainly yesterday's man in that respect. So it would be kind of interesting to see how like how that seems in a modern context, especially because like Trump is just makes such a joke of the entirety of politics that like you can't exactly just bolt him onto a critique of Citizens United or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think the thing that annoyed me the most was one of the sort of plot details is that the town was next to like this base that got shut down, and with it that was like loads of jobs went, and it like, you know, it's like a pit closing or whatever, you know, the entire lifeblood of the town is starves. But when you get there, it's just like you see a few boarded up windows, but everyone's basically fine and still like cooking pies and stuff. Whereas like if it really like depicted the sort of social, you know, the economic blight that had befallen it, I'd be like, okay, it's like the movie doesn't quite have the strength of its convictions. You know, it's angry, but it wants to be so digestible and light at the same time, and it can't quite square that circle.
Yeah. There might also be a problem of perspective in that if your contention is that people in Washington and from this elite media bubble had this patronizing view of the quote-unquote real Americans or working-class Americans or people in the Midwest or from small towns, and you are purporting to be able to show a more authentic version of that, but you clearly have more knowledge of and alignment with the media elites, right? Because that's the world that Jon Stewart is from. You know, and, you know, he hosted the Oscars.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
so that's setting yourself a challenge, a bit of a dangerous one. Hearing you talk about it reminded me a little bit of that awful Brexit film, The Uncivil War, where they have the focus group scenes with, you know, people out in the real world, outside the Westminster bubble. Like, here's what the real people are saying.
Yeah.
The weirdly sterile and fake world of focus groups presented as this totally transparent window onto how real people think. And it's clear that the writer of this play, he knows and understands the mind of, like, the politicians and journalists more than he does just working class people who don't have anything to do with that world, you know. And that came across painfully, even as his film was attempting to depict them as they truly are.
Yeah.
Did you get a similar impression?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, you know, it's from the stock, screenwriting book of, like, what are rural people like? They're all nice and they all know each other and they all drink at the same bar and they're like, you know, if you get lost, they'll help you because they're just good-natured, lovely folk who get shat on by the man. Yeah, just like... It's like, what's the point? You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to say something, but it just sort of copped out a little bit. I mean, I had a couple of good jokes, but I don't know. The early on in the movie, like, after Steve Carell's had, like, this crushing defeat. Another thing is that, like, it pans past all the people he's worked with, and one of them is, like, he was, like, key on the Clinton campaign. It's like, the Clinton campaign? It's like, was this guy on the Lolita Express? Like, you know. And, like, the morning after the 2016 election, he's, like, in bed. He can't get out of bed because he's so depressed. And, like, the phone's ringing. And then, like, his phone keep on, like, he's such an old man, he can't work technology. And, like, he's, like, Alexa, turn off the phone. Phone, turn off Alexa. And he's, like, trying to get all these things to thing work. And it's, like, it's kind of like a movie. It's, like, old man yells at technology. It's, like, it's a bit too on the nose. Like, this is what this film is like. I'm angry. I'm not about stuff. And I can't quite articulate it in a coherent way. But... yeah. One to miss. It was not irresistible to me.
Some sort of Washington PR campaign Democrat ghoul should be the villain of the film.
Yeah, exactly. Don't get Steve Carell. He's like sort of a, you know, a kind of budget Tom Hanks or something, you know? He's America's dad.
Yeah. He's Hanks.
He's Hanks.
That guy who plays Dan in Veep.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get
Reed
that guy.
Scott. Get him.
Some kind of real shit eater. Yeah.
Well.
So not a recommendation for Irresistible, which I keep wanting to say Irreversible, but I know that's a very different
That would be
film.
Such a sick double bill.
Steve was really the only, I really did write this for him and with him in mind. And so I'm very glad that he wanted to do it. Because it's a difficult character because it's, what do you do with someone that you might, who might believe in what they're doing ideologically, who might be very principled, but they live in a world that is less principled. And what does that do to them?
Okay. What do we have? What else do we want to discuss here?
I mean, it's been so long since we've spoken. I mean,
I saw that film Rampage with the Rock in it, and he's got a giant gorilla friend. Don't have a huge amount to say about that. You know, he's gorilla. So he's got a big gorilla.
So yes, that's such a weary way. I saw some film with a rock, and he's got a giant gorilla friend or something.
He's got a big gorilla. The gorilla starts big, but he just gets bigger as the film goes on. By the end, the gorilla is just huge, absolutely fucking huge.
If you could time travel back to 1998 and said that to somebody, they think you were mad. I just saw a film starring The Rock where a gorilla gets massive and massive.
Just gorilla gets really big.
Does he go on a rampage?
By the end, you're squinting and rubbing your eyes like, why is he so big? Oh yeah, he goes on a huge rampage.
Connor! It's okay. George! Easy, buddy. Easy. Okay. Oh, very funny. It's very funny. We're all very impressed. Yes. You and I laughing at your joke, okay? New guy, he no laugh. He cry. Yeah, opposite of laugh. Connor, you can get up now.
Are you 100% on that?
100% sure, you can get up.
And check your diaper, come on. Let's go.
So, Rampage. The trailer depicts three normal animals becoming enormous, right? A wolf and a crocodile and the gorilla. In the film, the wolf and the gorilla are the chief giant animals. And then there is a second sort of, or third act reveal where the crocodile becomes the biggest and baddest animal of them all. But my complaint is that was revealed in the trailer, and in the film I really felt like we needed a fourth animal because we knew the crocodile was coming. So for the film to really land, a fourth, even bigger animal should have arrived. And that didn't happen.
Yeah.
So what's the deal? I feel like this is a real problem with the movie. Or maybe that's down to the marketing and it should have just called itself Gorilla versus Wolf and just focused on that, and then that would have made the crocodile really exciting.
What was it going for? But, was it like basically like a sort of kaiju movie, just like big animals slugging it out in cities? Like,
yeah, it's like a sort of family fun at the cinema, but it definitely has a kaiju element. Certainly I would describe it as fine. The Rock is pretty charming in it. It was aiming pretty child friendly, I would say, aiming at kids, you know, the nine-year-olds will go for it. The villains were very kind of cartoony. There's like the woman who's the Spectre, Silk Spectre from Watchmen, Marlon Ackerman. That's the actress's name. It's come to me. She is the kind of bad guy in it, and she's some sort of tough business woman who's just doesn't care about anything but profits. And then her sidekick is this kind of bumbling, oafish younger brother who's like tripping up on his own shoelaces all the time, and is, you know, he's like, gee, I don't know if that's a good idea. And their dynamic is very broad, and that's the tone of the whole movie. It's very broad and silly. Is there anything else on our horizon that we...
We should review the new Charlie Kaufman movie. I mean, everyone's been locked inside for like 6 months. People's mental health hangs by a thread. And I'm like, I gotta watch me the new Kaufman movie. Apparently, it might be his most depressing film yet. So...
Oh, yes. Woo! Yes, please.
Sign me up. And I'm quite keen to watch the third Bill and Ted movie. I feel that, contrary to Charlie Kaufman, that would cheer me up. The adorable dude bro energy. And apparently the reviews have come out, and it's pretty good, apparently. Which I'm very pleased by, because it looked a bit like, you know... I mean, how many sort of, you know, late-in-the-day sequels are good? It often seems like a good idea at the time. Like, oh, I can't wait to see those guys back together. And then you're like, oh, man. But it's almost like the joke of how stupid and sweet they are is just funnier now they're old. At least, that's what the trailer suggests, so...
I want to find out if Keanu Reeves can still sell that dumb guy thing now that he has transformed into such a slick, sexy man. Like, he's, as a younger actor, he was considered to be, like, have a real dumb guy energy. I think that was what people thought about The Matrix, right?
Yeah.
He was kind of wooden in it and seemed, like, a bit, like, stupid or whatever. And then his latest John Wick incarnation, he just seems like an awesome... guy. He's no longer dumb, he's just nice, you know, he's sort of nice and cool and he kicks ass. So can he still successfully sell himself as the dumb bro.
You know, there's just that fine line between completely vacant and just like zen-like killer messiah. And he just, exactly. can That's you know, exactly it's a fine it. Line. And occasionally I think he fudged it in some of his movies, but I feel like he still got
he
it.
He needs to travel back from zen to vacant. Yeah. That's now a long journey for him.
Yeah, he's too cool these days.
So we'll see. I never seen the original Bill and Ted's.
Oh, they're great. I think they hold up. I mean, there's a couple like gay panic jokes in there, but for the most part, they're just adorable dudes. There's something quite nice. It's like soft masculinity. They're just guys. They're nice guys. They're a bit dim, but they just their whole thing is be excellent to each other. You know, they got a good vibes, yeah.
Well, those do sound like quite opposite vibe options, the Kaufman and Bill and Ted. So yeah, let's check them out. I'm interested to see the Kaufman. I'm sort of vaguely nursing the take that Charlie Kaufman isn't good, or it's just not that great. So yeah, I'll be interested to see his latest film. I'm sure it'll be very philosophical and existential and depressing. I mean, Synecdoche, New York was certainly a bit of a downer. So how far further down can he go, you know?
I watched Anomalisa and I like, which I know you weren't a huge fan of, but I like loved, and I was on such a sort of Kaufman, not exactly high, a low, I don't know, whatever the feeling is. I was like, oh, I haven't seen Synecdoche, New York since it came out in cinemas. I watched it again and I like, at the end I was like, that was a mistake. Oh god, it's only 2 hours long. But it's got just so...
I thought it was much long. I thought it was... Yeah, I thought it was like 2.5.
Well, here's the thing. It has like twice as many scenes as a 2-hour movie. It's like... It's basically like a montage for the last like 90 minutes of that film. So it feels so long. By the end, I was just like... I mean, it definitely... It might be a masterpiece. I don't know. I felt things, but yeah. I want good things. So... But should art comfort or should it just make you feel terrified and alone? Who knows?
Is he saying stuff about the human condition, or is he just being a miserable old bastard? That's my question about Charlie Kaufman. Does he just hate other people? Like, I don't know. I know I've talked about Anomalisa a number of times, so I'm not going to go back over it. But I feel like it's a little, it's simultaneously misanthropic and cute. You know, it's kind of relies on a little bit of cute romantic stuff, which is a little corny, and I think that his incredibly pessimistic, you know, how do we understand how other people are, we're all alone in this world, is also a bit corny and maybe not that deep, you know.
Well,
it's just,
I mean,
so that's my inkling, that's my current inkling, but I'm going to firm that up. I'm going to take that preconception and solidify it through his new film and not judge it at all except by how much it confirms my biases back.
Well, I'm gonna do the opposite, and then I'll be convincing you why you're just some fucking hipster idiot who like just wants to be a contrarian, can't appreciate genius when you see it.
Cool. All right
dude,
well, it's been nice chatting to you again, getting back on the horse. I'm sure that people will recognize how much our style and speaking manner has grown and become more professional, and how we're really hitting a groove.
Yeah,
you know, 218 episodes in, we're really, really getting there.
Yeah.
All right,
dude.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right. Let's do this again. Yeah. Let's do this again.
Let's do it. I'd like to say I'm fascinated by time because I've always lived in it. And it's a bit glib, but there's real truth to that, though, because we are all obviously living in time and living with time, and it's one of the things that causes us, it's one of the biggest influences on our lives, the biggest influence probably, and yet we're unable to fully understand it, we're unable to really grasp it or even explain what it is, quite frankly. And that's fascinating to me. It's one of the great enigmas that we all have to deal with every second of our day. And the relationship between that subjective experience of time and the ways in which we experience time changing at different points in our lives, different points in our day, the relationship between that subjective experience and the mechanism of cinema and how shot following shot following shot, builds up a narrative experience in the mind of the audience. You sit there in a cinema and you receive a story in roughly 2 hours, but the time span of that story can be minutes to centuries, to millennia. You know, it's all possible. And that's a fascinating relationship. And the mechanism whereby that relationship is exploited or takes place, to me, is fascinating. And I like the idea of exposing that mechanism and involving the audience in a discussion of that mechanism. Just trying to make them experience or notice the way in which a movie is making them feel about time.
Yeah.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.